When Robin Wall Kimmerer was a little girl, her family spent summers canoe camping in the Adirondacks. Each early morning, when the sun was barely up, her father would make a pot of coffee on the Coleman stove. And each time, before he drank his first cup, he would stop, pour a thin stream of coffee on the ground, and say thanks to the spirits of the mountain. Robin is a member of the Potawatomi Nation. She grew up in a culture that considers the earth our mother, plants and animals our oldest teachers. Today, she's also an award-winning scientist, a botanist who studies the ecology of forests and plants. In her work and in her life, she travels between scientific and traditional ways of knowing. And now, in a new book of essays called Braiding Sweetgrass, she weaves them together to help us understand the hidden world of plants. Her stories take us from the creation of Turtle Island to today's endangered ecosystems, and she offers us a vision of a renewed relationship with the earth, our home. Robin, welcome. It's such a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you, Anne. Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. Well, your book and your message seem especially appropriate to this Thanksgiving weekend, because there are two themes that run through it, thanks and giving. I really love that story about your father pouring the morning coffee on the ground. That was a regular ritual?
It was, absolutely, whenever we were out on the land, to start the day with Thanksgiving and, as you say, recognition of the gifts that are all around us. You don't take things for granted when you pause to say thank you.
Mm-hmm. Now, that was an invented ritual of his own, right? It wasn't quite something he grew up with?
Exactly. It was something that he felt called to do by those places. But it was really interesting to me as we connected back with our Potawatomi culture to find that, in fact, it was a really strong echo of our own practices, tribal practices of Thanksgiving. So there was an unknown connection there, I think.
Mm. And your story is typical of so many Native family stories, you know, this break from the long tradition of culture. How did that happen in your own family?
Well, the break really began, well, there are so many historical steps to it, of course, but the one that is most poignant for me is that my grandfather, who was 9 years old on our Citizen Potawatomi Nation Reserve in Indian Territory, i.e. Oklahoma, was taken as a really young boy east to the Carlisle Indian School. Whereas, you know, the mission of those boarding schools was total assimilation, to make people forget who they were, forget their ways of knowing, and replace them with those of the dominant culture. And so that was a really important break. And, you know, I remember as a kid asking my dad things about our culture, about our language, about ways of being, and he would just shake his head and say, you know, that was all left on the doorsteps of Carlisle Indian School. And so it has been a family practice and urge to reclaim and re-understand those ways of knowing.
How do you even go about doing that? I mean, for you yourself, and you have sisters too, I think, right?
Yeah, sisters and a brother. You know, because our history took us so far from our own people, some of my primary teachers of that kind of relationship was actually the land itself, the plants themselves. I think I was born a botanist. You know, I just spent so much time in the woods looking at the way the world was put together, and really adopted that notion that they could teach me many of the things that had been lost by history. So that was kind of my early immersion, I suppose. But then as I grew older and these great waves of cultural revitalization that are so powerful in Indian country today, we too became part of that wave of reclaiming and regenerating those things that had been lost.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying also is that you may have lost the direct transmission, you know, in your father's generation, but you still grew up in part of a culture that saw the world very differently than, say, Western science, your discipline now, sees it. You know, whether or not you got the language, the myths, the specific rituals, you still grew up with a kind of attachment and closeness to the land that maybe a lot of other kids didn't grow up with.
Yes, I really look back and say that, you know, did I grow up with a daily indigenous way of life? I did not. At least I didn't think so at the time. But what I did grow up with was exactly those values of gratitude and reciprocity and looking to the land as your teacher. I thought it was just the way my family was. But then when we connected with our big Potawatomi family, I realized that that was a cultural value that was widely held outside of our extended family.
Mm. Well, let's kind of make it real with a few stories, especially around plants. You've got, I really love the way in this book and in your essays, you start often with a particular plant and then you explore it both through personal story, through the history of your people, and then through botany, also kind of weaving all these together. So, for instance, pecan trees. You know, a lot of us are thinking about nuts at this season. A lot of people ate pecan pie yesterday, probably. And you have this lovely essay about nuts and nut trees that begins with an old family story about your grandfather.
It's true. I really laugh that when we would sit around the Thanksgiving table today, you know, two generations later, that what would be remembered about this remarkable, resilient, gifted man was the fact that when he was a boy, it was in hungry times in Oklahoma. He and his friends were out picking pecans, and the ground was just covered with these beautiful fruits, and he wanted to bring them home. So they had nothing to carry them in. So the story that came down to us is they took their pants off, filled the pants up with nuts, tied the legs shut, and carried them home that way. The gifts of the trees brought home.
Two little boys running home in their underpants.
Exactly. What an image, huh?
That's lovely. But so pecans, as you say, sounds like was a very important subsistence food during those hungry times. It could make all the difference to a family just trying to get through the winter.
Absolutely. And it is that closeness to the land, that remembering, that I think is so important, that what we do today is remember that we are sustained by the trees, by the land, by the plants all around us. In hungry times and in times when there's plenty, it's still those plants that are sustaining us, and that we need to sustain them in turn.
Yeah. And nuts especially. I mean, it's funny, I've just been reading new scientific studies lately that, people who eat an ounce of nuts a day live longer. I just had a scientist tell me the other day that people who eat nuts tend to be thinner for some reason. So there, I mean, it sounds like Western science is just discovering the importance of nuts and pecans. But I guess for hungry families living close to the land, they were a wonderful source of protein and fat, which I guess could be what you'd need to get through the winter.
Sure, just like the squirrels. And the thing about pecans is that those plants really greeted our people at the end of a really long journey. As you probably know, the Potawatomi peoples for much of our time lived in Wisconsin and the Upper Great Lakes. And then when we were removed first to Kansas and then to Oklahoma, our people were separated from the plants that sustained them, from the land that they knew. And there were the pecans there to greet them and take care of them. So I really think of them as a cherished kind of Thanksgiving food, to send that thanks to those pecans for taking care of the people in that time when they were under a great deal of stress and trying to adjust to a new homeland. The trees were there to take care of them.
Mm. There's something you write about also in terms of, it wasn't just the trees were there to take care of them. There's am I right that there's a historic pecan grove where the leaders of the Potawatomi people, there was an important historic decision to make?
Yes, exactly. They were originally removed to Kansas and given that land in perpetuity, so the treaty said. But in fact, there were pressures on that land as well. And so the people had to decide whether they would stay there on this communally held land in Kansas or whether they would move on yet again to Oklahoma, to Indian Territory. And the historical event that you're referring to is that they had to decide whether they would become citizens of the United States or not. And the way they understood it was that the United States government did not have the capacity or, in a sense, the values to protect communally held land, but they did have the capacity and the willingness to protect private property. So the big discussions that had to go on would the people set aside their devotion to communally held land, to this notion that land does not belong to us, and adopt this foreign way of thinking in order to safeguard the people. But the people were starving. They had next to nothing. They were literally destitute. And so they made that bargain to move to Oklahoma and accept allotment and private property in an effort to safeguard the people.
Can you play that out a bit? What the consequences of that decision would be? What does it mean to live in a culture of communal land? Ownership isn't the right word, versus living in a culture of where land is property.
The idea of property, that we own the land, that we are in charge of it, just goes against all of our traditional teachings of the land as animate, inspirited, and in fact, this generous provider and teacher for us. To have this notion that we own the land as individuals was really the antithesis of traditional culture, in which everything was shared. Just as the land shares with you, you share everything that the land provides. And of course, that imposition of the idea of land not as a gift, not as a literally as the provider, as the mother, but as property, was so foreign to us and had pretty bad consequences, because once that land was privatized, that land had to have taxes paid on it. Mm. That land could then be bought and sold, and during that era of the federal government property or policies of allotment, as much as 2/3 of the lands that were guaranteed to Native peoples were eventually sold off as private property.
Sure, just to pay the taxes. So that entrance into, I mean, that bargain really meant entering into a market economy, which was a completely foreign and different culture.
Indeed.
Yeah. Now, as a botanist, getting back to the pecan trees, as a botanist, yeah, you describe something really fascinating. It's kind of a scientific puzzle about nut trees, something called mast fruiting, which I hadn't heard of before. You should explain it.
Yeah, you know, trees like pecans, hickories, black walnuts, they don't fruit every year. They wait, depends, you know, on the trees and the situation, but they maybe every 3 to 5 years they pour out this great crop of fruit, which is known as mast fruiting, and the other years the trees are bare. And so in 1 year you get this great pulse of food, not only for people, but for squirrels and deer and turkeys and everybody else that relies on it. And so this boom and bust cycle is actually a strategy evolved by trees like that for their own survival.
So during lean years, they don't fruit, and during years where there's plenty of rain, plenty of sunshine, they have enough energy to fruit?
Well, for a while, that's what tree biologists were really trying to figure out. And there's some hint of that it is controlled by the abundance of resources. But there seems to be a good deal more sophistication going on than simply, do we have enough? They do have to store up enough carbon, enough sugars, right, to make these tons of nuts. But it isn't entirely driven by the abundance on the land. And what we are beginning to understand is that this mast fruiting is synchronous over the whole landscape, over the county, over a state. All of the trees are going to produce at the same time. And there's some
You mean if one produces, like if the nut tree on my farm decides to fruit 1 year, all the others in the whole state go ahead and fruit?
Yeah, it's synchronous across really large landscapes, whether it's the whole state or not, I don't know about that, but yeah, regionally, yeah, exactly. There are no soloists And in fact, a tree that fruited when everybody else was not would really be at risk. I mean, every squirrel in the county would come and eat all of your seeds. They'd be gone. But if everybody fruits at once, then you flood that predator population and you ensure that some of those pecans are going to get planted. Some of them are going to be forgotten by the squirrels and everybody else. And then that's the year that you get the regeneration of the seedlings that will make the next grove.
But how do the trees all know? Is there some signal? How do they all know that this is the year we're all going to fruit?
It's still a bit of a mystery, and it is perhaps related to resources, but there are some hypotheses out there that it may also be some kinds of chemical communication among the trees, that they are synchronizing with one another through pheromones wafted over the air. There are other hypotheses that because underground, what looks like a single individual of a tree, they're actually connected by a lot of root grafts and by fungal connections, and that they may be talking to each other underground and indeed balancing out the amount of stored up carbohydrate that they have and sharing it with each other. Then when everybody has enough, then everybody fruits. It's an amazing hypothesis to think about this kind of organization in beings that most of Western society looks at as pretty unsophisticated, just, you know, green objects standing there, but they've got a lot going on.
Well, that's fascinating also because, you know, we started by talking about how the culture you grew up in, the underlying assumption is that plants and animals have something to teach us, that they're not some lesser intelligent beings, and in fact they have intelligence. So, I don't know, I guess what would you say the lesson of the pecan tree is?
Well, the lessons of the pecans in that case, I really think that they were saying stick together, work together, because if you do it alone, if you act alone, you're much more vulnerable. But those pecans and trees like them, when acting in unity, they can regenerate themselves, they can protect themselves, but at the same time, they can feed the landscape around them. So it's a lesson to me in that all flourishing is mutual. What's good for one is good for the other.
It's fascinating listening to you to describe a philosophy of life that kind of seems to be dictated by the earth itself. So we can talk about that more when we come back. We're going to take a really quick break. I'm talking with Robin Wall Kimmerer. She's a professor of environmental and forest biology at the State University of New York. She is also a member of the Potawatomi Nation and author of a beautiful new book of essays. It's called Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teaching of Plants. We'd love to have you join the conversation as well. Are there lessons you've learned from spending time in nature, maybe from a particular plant or animal? Or do you have a question for Robin Kimmerer? You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234, 642-1234, or email us. The address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and you're listening to 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now we're talking with Robin Kimmerer about her beautiful new book of essays, Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teachings of Plants. And Robin, we've got a couple of people on the phone with questions or comments. Let's hear from Bob in Plain, Wisconsin. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Hi. Got a question or comment?
Just a comment. I'm interested in the conversation. It's very informative. But my comment was, I was just returned from up north deer hunting. They had a late frost up there this year. They have no acorns, no nuts at all on any of the trees.
Huh.
Down here, we didn't have a late frost. We had a lot of acorns. Last year, we had a late frost, and we had very few hickory nuts even, and no acorns. So I think a lot of that depends, she was stating, like, you know, different, like she didn't know all about all over the state.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll get, like, up north in the southern part of Wisconsin here are two different environments, it seems like, and they get early frost or late frost up there sometimes, and they a lot of years they don't have acorns.
Yeah, Robin, so it sounds like that that thing about whether well, the regions the trees communicate with may vary. Sometimes it's a big region, sometimes it's a small region. Robin, are you there?
I am, but we're having a technical difficulty. I think I can't hear the questioner.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. Well, Bob was calling from Plains saying that in northern Wisconsin and southern Wisconsin, the trees are doing different things. Partly they have different seasons, but there are, you know, acorns in one area and no acorns in another. So the question is sort of about how extensive those communities of trees are.
That's a really good question, and I think it varies from species to species. And, of course, northern and southern Wisconsin are ecologically so different from one another and being different bioregions that it would make sense to me that the two regions wouldn't be synchronous because of those different conditions. But I honestly don't know exactly what the extent of that synchronicity is.
Mm, okay, and let's also hear from Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Good morning, guys. Hey, let me put a vote in for the walnuts this year, at least in the south and the southwestern part of the state. Coming from kind of Milwaukee area here, I know of walnut trees still that have nuts on the ground. The squirrels haven't been able to carry them off. Coming back from the deer hunt in Crawford County, I know the folks out there were just reporting a fantastic year for walnuts to the point that, once again, some of the trees along the gravel roads in Crawford County, you could pick up bushels of nuts at this point, where in years past, you know, I'd heard the, you know, the theory that every, you know, 3 years, 5 years or whatever, but something clicked this year, at least across the southern part of Wisconsin, because, like I said, I have never seen a walnut crop, you know, at least, like I said, in Milwaukee County and Crawford County, that ever produced like it has this year.
Yeah, Bob, are you talking about black walnuts?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I don't even know. Does Wisconsin also grow? I grew up calling them English walnuts. You know, the kind you actually tend to buy in stores. Do we have those trees as well?
That I do not know. I only know of the black walnut here in Wisconsin.
Okay. Well, I love those because I grew up eating them. You can't buy them in stores, really, so I think of them as one of those really precious wild foods, and they also take a hell of a lot of work to get the nuts out of those are really thick shells. But, Robin, you'd probably know the answer to the question. Could you hear Mike?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, good.
That's good now. Thanks. Yeah, what an interesting thing. The English walnuts, of course, are non-native species that are grown, you know, for the fruits themselves, whereas the black walnuts are a constituent of the native landscape as well. And, you know, if this year is a particularly good mast year, wouldn't surprise me, because, of course, at least here in upstate New York and I think across the Great Lakes, we had so much fruit failure last year because of that crazy winter and the late frosts, that the carbohydrates that the plants may have, you know, stored up to fruit last year, they didn't use because the flowers were killed by frost.
Oh.
And so it might be that there is an especial surplus this year. Just a guess.
Oh, that's good. So we were talking, we began by talking about your dad's ritual and growing up kind of saying thanks and being aware of the many gifts that the earth provides us with, nuts being just one of them. But there's a story you tell in the book that I wanted to ask you to talk about. You said, as you said, you live in upstate New York near the Onondaga Reservation, and I was just so struck by the ceremony you described that happens in the school there, almost on a weekly basis, and it's kind of like the Onondaga people's counterpart to the Pledge of Allegiance, the Thanksgiving address. Can you tell us more about it?
Yes, I am privileged to live in the center of Haudenosaunee or Iroquois country, just a few miles from the Onondaga Nation. And all Haudenosaunee people have as one of their foundational principles what is known as the words that come before all else, or greetings and thanks to the natural world, also known as the Thanksgiving Address. And it's very beautiful, very moving, because no matter how many people are gathered, whether it's just two or whether it's 200, They are literally the words that come before all else, in which greetings and thanks are sent out by name to all of the elements, all of the other beings with whom we share the Mother Earth. And it's such a wonderful way to begin any gathering, to begin one's day with an orientation to gratitude, to understand that we're showered with all of these gifts. It's really a brilliant way to cultivate this attitude of reciprocity and gratitude.
The words are beautiful, too. Is there any of it you know by heart that you could say?
Well, I can say that often the way it begins is a sense of gathering our minds together as one. And that's really the point of the Thanksgiving address, to can we bring our minds together as one and send Thanksgiving, love, and respect to the Mother Earth. And then the things that Mother Earth is giving us are named. We say that we put our feet on the ground and acknowledge that Mother Earth is still here doing her duties, giving us all that we need. And can we bring our minds together as one to send respect to Mother Earth? And then the people are named, the moon, the stars, the water, the berries, the medicines, the four-legged, the swimmers, the crawlers. Everybody is named in turn. And by the time the Thanksgiving address is done, you just feel so wealthy. You feel as if everything that you need is already here, and that our role is to be grateful for those things and to ensure their continuity. I think of that as so poignant. I'm so glad that you asked, especially here on Black Friday, when all of the marketers are screaming at us that we have to take more from the earth, that we don't have enough. The Thanksgiving address really reminds you that you have everything you need already. And it cultivates that sense of gratitude and contentment, which is kind of radical in a consumer society.
Yeah. I'm just trying to imagine what a gift to raise children in a culture of gratitude. I mean, what do you think are the deep impacts on children who grow up? Because from what I understand, they say the Thanksgiving address every week in school, and it's long. It takes a long time to thank all those beings. What do you think the deep impacts are when you grow up in a culture of gratitude?
Part of that, I think, is it cultivates, again, this sense of contentment, but it also cultivates a sense of humility to understand that we're not alone on the planet, that we are part of this wonderful web of reciprocity, each taking care of the other. It cultivates a sense of belonging. It also cultivates, I think, a sense of personal agency, because not only in the process of naming the gifts that are given us by all of the plants, the animals, the land, the water, you also are called upon to say, what's my gift? What is it that I should be giving to the earth to be part of this whole wonderful web of giving and taking?
So do you think of Western culture, European culture, as a culture of taking?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So many of the questions that we ask are, you know, what more can we take from the earth? And let's face it, we have to take from the earth, don't we? We can't photosynthesize. As a botanist, I sure wish I could. But we can't. We that's the way the world works. Humans are animals. We have to take from the earth. And so the question that we really have to address is, what is our response to that taking? What is our response to the gifts of the world? And that's why our people had many, many protocols associated with cultures of gratitude to ameliorate the taking that we have to do in order to live. There are protocols associated with the honorable harvest, for example, which we think of as ancient teachings for a subsistence economy. But let's face it, we are still in a subsistence economy. Everything.
What's the honorable harvest?
Well, the honorable harvest is collectively a group of teachings that guide people in our taking. Because as you said, we are people who have to take from the earth. But when you go to pick medicine, or you go to pick berries, or you go hunting or fishing, there are protocols for how you do that. They involve many different teachings associated with the personhood of these beings that we're taking, to understand that what we're taking, we don't own. What we're taking are the lives of other beings. So we have to do that honorably. One of the most important teachings is that you only take what you need. And our needs and our wants in Western society are all tangled up. I think we can't tell them apart anymore. But to think about what it is that you really need and take only that.
Well,
everything.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, so much has to do with the kind of stories that you're told, right? So here it is, Black Friday, and you were talking about the stories that we're inundated with in advertising. The stories are about what you might want, what you might need, where the shortage is in yourself. You know, the underlying message is that you're missing something. So you go out and buy it and fill up that empty space inside, right? But it sounds like you grew up with a very different story. And I guess what you're saying is living close to the land and paying attention to the natural world shows you that we have everything we need.
Exactly, exactly. And it cultivates that sense of contentment and the importance not of taking, but of now saying, well, having been showered with these gifts of the earth, what are my gifts that I can give back? You know, even our definitions of sustainability, which are laudable in this country, but if you think about how we define sustainability, basically what it is a formula for by which we can figure out how to keep on taking from the earth into the future without impairing its ability to provide for us. But the indigenous view of sustainability is not to ask, what can we how can we continue to take from the earth? But what is it that we as human people have to give to the earth? What does the earth ask of us is the organizing principle.
But what does it ask of us? What could I possibly give to a forest? What could I possibly give to a black walnut tree?
What a wonderful question. One of the answers, of course, is gratitude. And that's what the Thanksgiving address of the Haudenosaunee and its parallels throughout Indian country. You give gratitude. But gratitude might seem like kind of this weak tea given the environmental challenges we face. But it's not, because in gratitude, you first of all recognize that we as human people are utterly dependent on the gifts of all the other species with whom we share the planet. And that's a pretty important teaching. But there's also this notion that by paying attention, by recognizing what in the indigenous philosophy we would call the personhood of all those other beings, that we start to treat all of these other beings not as objects, not as commodities or property, but as other beings who are due respect and responsibility. And that changes everything when you look at the world as a gift and not as your own property.
We're talking with Robin Wall Kemmerer. She's a professor of environmental and forest biology at the State University of New York. She's also a member of the Potawatomi Nation and author of a beautiful new book of essays called Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teachings of Plants. We'll be right back, and we welcome your calls. In the meantime, 1-800-642-1234. We've been talking about gratitude toward the earth. I wonder if there is a way in which you try to articulate that in your own life. 800-642-1234 to join the conversation, or you can email us. The address is talk@wpr.org. We'll be right back. I'm Ann Strange Champs. You're listening to 45 North, and we're talking with Robin Wall Kemmerer this morning. She's a professor of environmental studies, a botanist, member of the Potawatomi Nation, and author of this gorgeous new book of essays called Braiding Sweetgrass. And Robin, one of the things I wanted to make sure to ask you about is the Potawatomi language, which as you said, you know, it was your family lost when your grandfather was sent off to one of those boarding schools. You recently set out to learn the Potawatomi language yourself. How hard is that?
I found it an immense challenge, but also a great joy in doing that. And again, throughout Indian country, there is a wonderful language revitalization movement happening, so that even I, living remotely from my nation in upstate New York, I can sign on to, you know, an online language class from Oklahoma, and study language in that way. There are immersion camps and all kinds of online resources, as well as the in-person connections that happen in community and at our tribal gatherings and classes.
Now, have you seen that closeness to the land, that different attitude toward nature, reflected in the Potawatomi language as you've begun to learn it? Are there words, for instance, that don't translate, that we don't have in English?
Absolutely. And these words capture the worldview that we have been talking about of the personhood of other beings. One of the words that really captivated me for the longest time was a word, papoi. And I happened on that word in a book by an Anishinaabe ethnobotanist, Kiweda Nokwe. And she talked about this wonderful word, and you know what it means. It means the force which causes mushrooms to push up out of the earth overnight.
Oh, the fact that's beautiful.
isn't it? You know, as a biologist, I think, oh gosh, our biological language is depauperate. We do not have words for this amazing life force. And when I learned that word, it reignited for me the longing for that lost language. If there was a people, if there was a thought system that contained a word for the life force of mushrooms, I wanted to learn it. And one of the things that has made my very rudimentary attempts at learning Potawatomi both beautiful and really challenging is the grammar. It contains what I would call the grammar of animacy.
Wow. What is that?
It's, you know, one of the best ways perhaps to say what it is to say at first what our native language, English, is not. You know how in English we refer to each other as persons, but if we referred to that maple tree outside our windows, we would have to refer to it in English as it. Mm-hmm. That the rest of all of the living world we speak of as if it is inanimate, as if it's a thing. In English, you're either a human or you're an object. But in Potawatomi, this grammar of animacy means that we have the linguistic structure to speak of the living world as if it were alive, as if it was a person, as if it were our family, because in our way of thinking, it is. And isn't that, it's so interesting that in English that has supported this, let's be honest, in many cases a pretty exploitative way of thinking about the earth, as if it was just stuff, as if it was just a commodity. Well, that's what our language lets us do. It only lets us speak of water as if it was an it, not as if it was a who.
But does that mean I don't know, if you're talking about the lake or the forest, that you refer to it as he or she, or is it something more than that?
Well, it's not necessarily gendered. You know, our the Romance languages do have these cases for gendering. We'll say he or she, but in Potawatomi ways of speaking and thinking of the world, there's something for which there is no equivalent, really, in English, and that is the animate being who is not a human, but is still animate and still has intention and will and intelligence. Speaking in that way reminds us that we're living in this amazing web of other beings, that we're not alone. We don't have to solve all the problems on our own. There's these other beings out there who are alive and able to, you know, that are part of our living world. Mm. But it makes the grammar difficult, but it's such a beautiful, powerful, transformative idea. I'm happy to struggle through the verbs.
It sounds like, you know, you learn a language and you also learn along with it a kind of habit of mind. I want to take another call. We've got Esty on the line from Madison. Good morning, Esty.
Good morning, and thanks. This is such a wonderful show, and especially really on Black Friday. I wanted to say that, first of all, when we're talking about what we can give back to the trees, that I personally certainly talk to my trees and identify personalities and have, if you excuse me, hug trees and ask them questions and get incredible answers that have taken me on internal journeys to places that were really very important to me and have changed me in significant ways. But to go to more practical ways by which we can have a relationship with a tree and give it back, we can give it manure, and we can try and make sure that the manure comes from cows that have been fed sustainably and are not full of antibiotics and chemicals. We can compost our food and therefore have much less waste and give that to the tree. We can make sure that there's no chemicals on the tree. A friend of mine who practices permaculture recently came and sprayed my brand new fruit trees with beneficial bacteria, I think, that came from kombucha. So there's a lot of things we can do to give back, and by doing that, we actually provide ourselves and our neighbors and the general environment a much better life. So it really is a back and forth. It really is a mutual relationship, and the more we give, really, we see that the more we get, the better life we give to ourselves. Mm-hmm.
Esty, that you just perfectly described, I think, what Robin is, Robin, the underlying message in your book, which is about trying to get us to really comprehend in a deep, felt way that reciprocal nature between us and the natural world. Am I putting it right?
Oh, you're putting it perfectly, as did Esty. This notion that we as human people have our own gifts, and they are largely gifts of care. Everything you said about permaculture, about giving back to those particular trees, absolutely. And that's on that really local, intimate kind of scale. But when you think about all the other acts that we can engage in to take care of land, you know, working with land trusts, reconnecting with our families and communities so that we pay attention to our natural landscapes, know what's going on with them as climate change rushes toward us, what's going on, and be a personal agent of caretaking. And, you know, sometimes if you have those trees around you, if you have a landscape that you can care for in a very physical way, I think we're called to do that. But in an age of urbanization, a lot of people don't have that and are very frustrated by this idea that, well, what is my currency of reciprocity? How can I give back to the earth when I live in a high-rise, in a city? And it used to be, of course, that when we all lived close to the land, we had a currency of reciprocity through our direct land care for taking care of that land. But when you can't, what do you do? And I think, again, particularly on this big marketing hype day of overconsumption, it's to remember that currency has become, our money has become the currency of reciprocity. We can choose. We can choose to engage in this honorable harvest, whether that honorable harvest are berries that we're taking directly from the land, or are they other products that we're consuming, which do ultimately come from the earth. We can make choices about whether we're going to consume those things that inflict damage on the earth, or whether we're going to make other choices. So our currency itself can become a source of engaging in reciprocity and gratitude with the earth.
Mm. Is that why the Potawatomi people I think I got this right from your book, Won't Sell Sweetgrass. I mean, the concept that there are some things that just really should not be sold, and sweetgrass being a plant that is especially sacred.
Absolutely. It gets back to the place where we began in thinking about the earth as communal property or communal subsistence, or is it private property? We don't own those plants. Those plants are persons, and I don't mean to anthropomorphize and say that they are like humans, but they are their own sovereign entities. It's not for us to sell them. And this notion of understanding all of the other beings as persons, as sovereign entities, really changes the way that you are in the world. It changes how much you feel you ought to take. It cultivates self-restraint and opens that door to reciprocity, to say, if I'm going to take, I have to give something back too.
Mm. I want to take another call. We've got Sarah on the line from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
This is such a cool show. And I just wanted to, when you started talking about language, I got excited, more excited, because a few years ago I tried to, I speak French, Spanish, and English right now, and a few years ago I tried to learn Ojibwe, and I'm with like a Pimsleur language tape thing, and it was so cool. And I realized after looking at all the vocabulary for a while that the structure, the entire structure of the language and grammar, just like you're saying, it seems to come from this different place where you can see in the structure how it's all about having in your mind that people are just a small part of this huge nature, you know, that there's this huge connected world and we're just this one little web of it, and the structure and the grammar show that. And it's really hard for me to kind of explain how that was, because it was really hard to grasp. It was so different, but it seems like there was people and words would relate to places a lot, like they're. Anyway,
I want to see what Robin says, because I think you wrote something about that, Robin, right? That it was sort of fiendishly difficult at first, almost as though you had to expand your mind, learn a new way of thinking to grasp some of the language.
That's exactly right. And I'm so glad you mentioned that, Sarah, because Ojibwe and Potawatomi are very closely related languages. So we've shared that struggle. And one of the things that really differentiates them, particularly in this idea that a worldview is embedded in the language, just as you say, is that English is, I forget the percentages, but it's in the neighborhood of 60 to 70% of the words in English are nouns. Whereas that fraction is reversed in Potawatomi and Ojibwe, that they're verbs.
More of the language is verbs?
Is verbs, huh. Exactly. So, and so it conveys a world in motion, a right. world of animacy. Again, the things that we would say in English are a noun, like a stream. That's a noun, right? Well, no, it's a verb in Potawatomi, to be a stream. Because the water's alive. It conveys that notion that the world is alive and dynamic and always changing. And so a stream is not a static thing. It's a way of being. And so this struggle in converting your whole lens of looking at language from a noun-based to a verb-based language really captures that worldview of an animate universe.
What a beautiful notion. Oh, that's just gorgeous. That's something I'm taking away with me today. Thank you. Thank you very much. So we don't have much time left, really, about another minute or so, Robin, but I'm curious, we alluded early, of course, to I think we all feel so much fear these days about the state of the planet, the future of the environment. You know, scientists tell us we've reached the point where we've done too much damage to retreat from. Where do you find hope?
I find hope in actually looking at many of those damaged places, which in fact show incredible resilience. Life wants to continue. So there's a great deal of resilience that I see in plants and in the earth herself. And when we look at all the damage we've inflicted, it's easy to think that the earth has been broken, that the land is broken. But it's our relationship with land that's broken, and we have the power to change that. We can choose to consume with honor from the earth. We can choose to consume less. We can choose to understand the world as gift and respond accordingly. There are so many messages out there that make us feel like we're powerless, but each of us can choose the pathway of honorable consumption, of living with gratitude and reciprocity, and thereby create a transformative movement. I think that's what we need. Not more policy, not more data, not more money, but a change of heart.
Robin, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Ann. My pleasure.
Robin Wall Kimmerer. She's a professor of environmental and forest biology at the State University of New York, a member of the Potawatomi Nation, and author of a new book of essays. It's called Braiding Sweetgrass: Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teachings of Plants. We've only touched on a few of the chapters in the book. There's a lot more. I'm Ann Strain Champs, and there is also more of 45 North coming up after the news. Stay tuned.